Welcome to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Wednesday, August 16th, 2023. The Barnes Review History Hour is a program featuring contributors to the Barnes Review History Magazine, a bi-monthly print and digital publication dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts, as well as other special guests. Please do consider subscribing to the magazine if you are not already. Check out barnesreview.org for all the details. And today I am joined by Vaughn Klingenberg, a longtime subscriber to the Barnes Review and a contributor to the magazine. All right, Vaughn Klingenberg, welcome to the program, sir. How are you today?
I'm doing very well, John. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's great to connect. It's good to talk to you. This is our first conversation that we've had. I know you're a longtime reader of the Barnes Review magazine, and you've also contributed articles in the past. Yeah. And you're also a contributor to VTForeignPolicy.com. I've seen your articles published there. And then you also maintain your own website, which features some of the books that you've written. And that website is booksbyvk.org. And I will have links over to your author page on VTForeignPolicy.com as well as your book page when I post this podcast program for anybody interested in checking out your work there. To get started, since, you know, we're basically meeting each other for the first time here, can you kind of just tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and sort of your experience in the revisionist movement, maybe like how you became interested in the revisionist sort of message of history and that sort of thing?
Well, I guess it's important to admit to having a degree in philosophy. I have a master's degree in philosophy from Marquette University, where I taught law graduates. I guess, you know, one thing I've learned from my studies in philosophy is that, you know, if somebody tells you you're not supposed to think a certain way, or if you're not supposed to, you know, talk about certain topics, That is something that pricks my interest and makes me want to know why am I not supposed to talk about that topic? Why is that issue forbidden? So, you know, in my studies in philosophy, I really appreciated the fact that anything goes, you know, that no topic is forbidden. When I first, you know, I have to admit, when I first was young, you know, in high school and that age, when I heard people criticize or label people Holocaust deniers and such, you know, that, you know, I was of the opinion when I was very young that, you know, there was something wrong with people who were denying the Holocaust. You know, they must be, you know, mentally ill or closet Nazis or what have you. But over time, in particular, because of you know, Israeli brutality towards the Palestinians, I became to be more skeptical of people who condemned Holocaust revisionists. And, you know, it was a slow gradual process, but eventually I came to realize that there are some very profound epistemological issues with the Orthodox account of the Holocaust. And, you know, once I realized that, I started reading different authors, and I came to the conclusion that there's a bigger story that needs to be told. And with that in mind, I do want to mention one thing right off the top here. You know, the Jewish community should really welcome Holocaust revisionists, because what we're, we're not their enemies. We're trying to help them understand and get a better and more accurate and honest account of the Holocaust. And we owe this to everyone involved in the Holocaust, Jew, Gentile, and German alike. Since Jews do not permit anything that contradicts the Orthodox Jewish account of the Holocaust, their account of the Holocaust is non-falsifiable and therefore unscientific. And in that, for that reason, they really, in all honesty, they're the Holocaust deniers, not the people they label Holocaust deniers. And one last point I want to mention about that is that, given that this is true, the Orthodox Jewish account of the Holocaust is a dogma. It is not a scientifically testable hypothesis. And I think it's important to underline that, and also to recognize that Holocaust revisionists were not the enemies of the Jewish community. We're trying to help them, and unfortunately, they don't see us that way.
Yeah, no, those are all really good points. Just to kind of follow up, was there anything in particular that sort of made you start thinking more critically about, you know, the alleged Holocaust and World War II more generally? I mean, you had mentioned how, you know, when you first sort of encountered the concept of, you know, quote unquote Holocaust denial, you thought that, you know, they were evil or they were mentally ill or, you know, Nazi, you know, they were a Nazi or something like that. So what sort of like changed your mind and like led you to start questioning it, you know, on a deeper level, I guess?
Well, I think a lot of it had to do with, you know, what the Israelis were doing to the Palestinians, and then recognizing how American media coverage is thoroughly biased when it comes to giving an account of Israeli-Palestinian relations in Palestine. And, you know, that, you know, it was a gradual evolution because, you know, there are a lot bigger topics here because, I living in a bubble, a media bubble here in the U.S., I mean, literally over 90% of the American media is either owned outright by Jewish shareholders or run by Jewish CEOs. And I succumbed to, the Jewish moral vocabulary that was inculcated in the mind of the public. And, you know, it took a while for me to realize that, you know, the bias in the coverage, not just of Palestine, but, you know, realizing the issues in Palestinian-Israeli relations got me to think about the Holocaust, because that was the justification for Israel. And, you know, how can it be that, you know, Jews who suffered the Holocaust are visiting that same brutal treatment on Palestinians? It just didn't make sense. And, you know, I began to recognize the hypocrisy, the profound hypocrisy in the media and even within the Jewish community about, you know, getting an accurate and unbiased account of the Holocaust. And then plus, you know, I later came to realize that in Europe, you go to jail and you get fined if you contradict the Orthodox account of the Holocaust. And, you know, if the Holocaust was true and if Orthodox Holocaust scholars were so sure of their information, why are they using the apparatus of the state to silence dissidents? So for all those reasons, I came to realize that there's some problems. And also right. the other issue is I've traveled abroad. I've lived in Europe for 2 years. I visited Israel for a year, not a year, for a month. So I was exposed to different media, and that, you know, recognize, you know, once you get outside of the media cocoon of the United States, and you realize that different countries have different issues that they cover and different countries are interested in, you begin to recognize that there is a bias in your own national media, and it really helps to travel to see that. So, it was just a slow evolution, but eventually it snowballed, and once I realized the power and the influence of the Jewish community, that really got me interested in getting to an accurate account of the Holocaust.
Interesting. Okay, cool. Yeah, no, that sounds very similar to my path, I guess, to a certain extent. One thing that struck me, and you sort of talked about this, you know, in your response, is just the inability for anybody to even engage in any sort of questioning or, you know, asking for clarification on certain things when it comes to the Holocaust. I mean, you just have to blindly accept what these people say about this purported event. You know, you're not allowed to question any aspect of it. In fact, if you do, it's a sign that you're this evil monster, you know, that wants to kill 6 million Jews yourself. I mean, it's really this dogmatic, totally weaponized narrative that has been used very, very effectively. And we can talk a little bit more about that as we proceed here. I got to ask you, go ahead.
I just want to follow up on what you just said, because one of my favorite quotes is from Karl Marx, you know, who was Jewish. And his very succinct quote was that the ruling ideas are the ideas of the ruling class. And, you know, in our society, in American society, we have a Jewish moral vocabulary. The absolutely worst thing you can label someone here in the West, at least in the U.S., is an anti-Semite, a Holocaust denier, a Nazi, a Hitler, a racist, and so on. You know, if we lived in the East, in China or Japan, we'd have a different moral vocabulary. But here in the West, we have a Jewish moral vocabulary, and that's been inculcated into the public through the media, because, like I said, over 90% of the media is controlled by Jews or Jewish shareholders. And so what results from that is that if a Gentile wants to denigrate someone to the highest degree possible, he has to rely on the Jewish vocabulary to denigrate someone. And, you know, with that in mind, you know, it's an interesting question. You know, does a fish know that it swims in water? And does a Gentile know that his moral vocabulary is manufactured? You know, those are questions that people should be asking. But I didn't mean to sidetrack you, John. So
fine. No, it's no problem. I appreciate your comments. I think you're onto something there for sure. So I got to ask you also, how did you come across the Barnes Review, and how long have you been a subscriber?
I've been a subscriber for about 4 years, if not more. Where did I come across it? That's a good question. I remember running across it once in a bookstore. And, you know, it was so different from the other opinion magazines that were on the shelf. In fact, I was surprised that they even had it, because it, you know, it gave a sympathetic account of Hitler. It wasn't just, you know, bumper sticker cliches and demonization. It actually, you know, tried to understand the Nazi movement and different figures within Nazi Germany. So that was my first exposure to it. I mean, I was a little put off initially, because I was, like I said, when I was younger, I thought anyone who criticized the Jewish community should be damned. You know, they shouldn't be allowed to speak. But eventually, through looking things up on the internet and, you know, talking to friends and family and others, I came to realize that, the Barnes Review is an excellent magazine. It's not afraid to publish things that contradict the status quo. And in fact, I'm a little surprised it's still published. You know, I'm surprised it hasn't been shut down or, in any number of ways interfered with. So it's a real jewel in the media to have something like the Barnes Review or the American Free Press. I mean, I can only encourage people, and I've done this. I've bought subscriptions to my friends and relatives, because this is word has to get out, and the word that has to get out is the information that publications such as the Barnes Review and the American Free Press are publishing. And I also have to give you credit, John, as well as Paul Angel, for being fearless editorialists and editors of these publications. So kudos to you guys.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate that. Yeah, and I completely agree with everything you said. I mean, I've been subscribing since, I think it was 2012 when I first got a subscription. I remember listening to the late Michael Collins Piper, who was a longtime contributor to both the Barnes Review and American Free Press. And he would always talk about the magazine, and I was like, wow, I gotta get a subscription to that. And it's always been just an outstanding publication. Excuse me. And with that, I do want to just encourage everybody listening, if you're not already subscribing, if you've never subscribed before, consider picking up a subscription. It is, as you mentioned, it is sort of surprising that, you know, we've been able to maintain the publication for this long. And it is not an easy thing to do. You know, there's, I mean, even like these big mainstream, like corporate publications can't even maintain a print publication. You know, it's just an increasingly more and more difficult thing to do, you know. And we're able to do it largely because we have such a good subscriber base and people that support us. So I would just recommend, you know, if you have never picked up a copy of the magazine, go out and pick up a subscription. It's not a lot of money. And it's definitely supporting a good cause, something that I think is very, very much necessary in our modern society, especially with all the censorship we see on social media and, you know, debanking, you know, deplatforming on major financial services. So it's a huge issue. And I've always been an old school, like newspaper, magazine, book type guy. Like I want a physical copy of something to sit down and read. And, you know, I think there's still a lot of people that appreciate a printed publication. So, again, I would just highlight and encourage everybody to consider picking up a subscription if they do not have one already. And then another sort of related question, kind of a broader question about your views of revisionism in general. What, are there any like particular books or authors maybe that stand out that like had a major influence on your thinking about the concept of revisionism, about the official narrative of World War II more broadly?
Well, I mean, the book by, there's been several books. I'm not very good with remembering the names of the authors, but, I do know that, you know, I have purchased several books through library or the book selling offered by the Barnes Review. Some of the books I've read recently, one was Hitler on the Jews. I read that because I wanted to know what exactly he said about the Jews. I also had one of your books, it was a Nazi publication published, I believe, in 1933 and reproduced by the Barnes Review Publishing House about the Jewish composition of people in the German hierarchy prior to the election of Hitler and the Nazis to Germany. I've also been reading, Alison Weir wrote a book. What was the title of her book? Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel. I've read that. Butz's book, I've read his. And, gosh, I can't remember the names of the others. But, I've read several books. And articles, you know, in the Barnes Review and elsewhere. So sorry, I'm not good with author names
okay. It's fine. I understand. I mean, there's a huge collection of books that the Barnes Review offers, and mm-hmm. I've purchased many of them over the years, and you know, it'd be tough for me to sit down and you know, list like five or six books because there's so many. So let's kind of jump into this topic then. You've written a book, and this was actually the subject of an article that the Barnes Review published. And forgive me, I can't remember exactly what issue it was. It was a few years ago. The big Jews versus the little Jews, that sort of concept when it comes to the Holocaust. Do you remember what issue that was published in?
That was published in the September October 2021 Barnes Review.
It was like 2 years ago. That's right.
Yeah. It started on page 64. And that article really does summarize my current view of the Holocaust.
That's what I definitely want to get more into here. Because, I mean, you wrote a book called The Big Lie, The Holocaust, An Introduction to the Greatest Fraud of the 20th Century.
That book is correct.
I mean, this is the article is basically like essentially what this book is about, right?
Well, I wrote that book before I wrote The Holocaust, Big Zionist Jews versus Little Jews. I mean, I have some there are some differences between the two books. I'm working on a second edition to update it. But in essence, yes, they both argue basically the same thing, that Zionists were the main culprits behind the Holocaust and not the Nazis.
Okay, I see, yeah. And I'm actually looking on your website, the books by VK.org, and I'm looking at the page for this particular book. And you say here, in essence, I argue here that quote-unquote big Jews conspired with the Allied leadership both before and during World War II to once and for all silence criticism of both the Jewish community as well as the Zionist movement. They did this by orchestrating having quote-unquote little Jews murdered in the Holocaust in order to foment Jewish immigration to Palestine and found a Zionist state after the war. After mm-hmm. World War II, the flourishing anti-Zionist movement was effectively dead. Virtually all Jews are Zionists now. I'd like for you to kind of elaborate on that. I do got to say right off the bat, though, I sort of have a problem with just using the word Holocaust, because, I mean, if you understand, like, the mainstream, what most people think about and the way it's defined and articulated in the media, in our educational establishment, is basically a systematic policy by the Germans during World War II to mass murder the Jews in Europe under, you know, that they came into contact with or that were under their authority. And it was largely carried out using homicidal gas chambers at these death camps. Now, I think revisionists have conclusively, beyond any shadow of a doubt, 100% disproved those three main pillars of the official Holocaust story. So just the way – I mean, I don't even view the quote-unquote Holocaust as a legitimate scholarly interpretation of what happened during this period. And maybe you can address that before we kind of get into the – you know, your overall thesis about, you know, the quote-unquote big Jews conspiring with the Allied leadership.
Sure, sure, yeah, yeah. Just to let you know, John, unfortunately, the connection's a little bit poor now and then, but I understand what your central question is, and let me summarize my thesis about the Holocaust. There was a problem. I mean, Zionism was a minority movement at the turn of the century, at the beginning of the 20th century. And the reason it was a minority movement is because most Jews were not Zionists. They did not want to leave the comforts of Europe and reestablish themselves in the barren countryside of Palestine. So the problem the Zionist Jews, and I call them the big Zionist Jews because they were very influential and powerful people, members of different organizations, which I'll get to in a moment.
But by the way, just to clarify, and I hate to cut you off here, but I just want some clarification. When you say the quote unquote big Jews, you're referring to like the major, you know, world Zionist leaders that were organizing the World Zionist Conference in Europe and formulating this idea of a future Jewish state. People like Samuel Untermeyer, and some of these other like bigger leaders.
Oh yes, definitely. Yeah,
Stephen Wise.
Oh yeah, definitely. And
you're arguing that this was like sort of a fringe movement. It wasn't very popularly accepted by the vast majority of the Jewish community, is that right?
That is correct. Yes, most Jews, like I said, did not want to leave the comforts of Europe and resettle in Palestine. That's simply true. And so there was a problem with these big Zionist Jews, and I call them big Zionist Jews because they were the heads of major Jewish organizations such as Stefan Wise and Yitzhak Greenbaum and others. And, you know, so what they needed to do is they needed somehow to get hitherto non-Zionist Jews, ordinary Jews, to convert to Zionism. And the way they did that is in World War II, what they did is once the war – I mean, Hitler wanted Jews to emigrate from Germany. In fact, Nazi Germany was the most pro-Zionist country in Europe before the war. So, but, you know, there was the Havara Agreement of 1933, where the Nazis and the Jewish community of Germany signed an agreement to to allow Jews to sell their property and wealth in Germany, and then the German government would transfer their assets to Palestine. So, the Nazis were very pro-Zionist. They were the most pro-Zionist country in Europe. So what happened, however, is once the war began, that basically shut down any movement of that basically ended the Havara Agreement, because during times of war, they didn't want to transfer Jews away out of the country who would later possibly join the Allied cause against them. So what the big Zionist Jews did is they conspired among themselves to exacerbate the suffering of Jews within the concentration camps with the goal of converting them into Zionist Jews, so that once the war ended, they would willingly resettle in Palestine. In fact, there's some important quotes here. Like, for example, Yitzhak Greenbaum, who signed the Israeli Declaration of Independence, and he was the head of the Jewish Agency Rescue Committee. How ironic. And anyway, one of his quotes was, "One cow in Palestine is worth more than all the Jews of Europe." You know what I mean? I mean, and he was in charge of a Jewish rescue agency during World War II. Another quote of his was made, and this is him: "I think it is necessary to state here, Zionism is above everything. I will not demand that the Jewish agency allocate a sum of 300,000 or 100,000 pounds sterling to help European Jewry. And I think that whoever demands such a thing is performing an anti-Zionist act." So, there's a logic to Yitzhak's position, but it's the logic of genocide. In fact, there were numerous things like that. In Alison Weir's book that I mentioned earlier, she has a chapter six, Forging and Ingathering of All Jews, where she basically goes through and gives accounts of how Zionist Jews intimidated and even killed fellow Jews through false flag operations in order to get them to remove themselves from Iraq, for example, and resettle in Palestine. And just another thing to keep in mind is that there was a ship of the British had an issue with Jews resettling in Palestine because it would alienate the Arab citizens living in that part of the world. And what they did is they discouraged Jews from resettling in Palestine because they wanted to keep their local natives happy and not have them. They didn't want a civil war happening in the Middle East while they were fighting the Germans. And what the Zionists did is there was a boatload of Jews. Let me see if I can find the name of the ship. The ship was the Patria, and it had 1,800 Jewish refugees that were relocating from Europe to Palestine. And it was parked in the Haifa harbor on November 25th, 1940. And the British would not allow the refugees to disembark because they didn't have any authorization to settle in Palestine. So they were kept on the boat. So what the Jewish Zionists did, in fact, I think it was Haganah. Yeah, it was Haganah, a Jewish terrorist organization. They placed a bomb on the ship and detonated it under the waterline of the ship. And as a result of that, they sunk the ship. It sank within 16 minutes. And of the 1,800 Jewish refugees on the boat, 267 were killed and 172 Jews were injured. But ultimately, the Zionists got what they wanted, because with the boat sinking and with the carnage of the boat explosion, the British allowed the remaining refugees to settle in Palestine. But that just goes to show how callous, the Zionist Jews were towards their fellow Jews. I mean, they were willing to kill fellow members of the Jewish community in order to get them to settle in Palestine. And one other thing I want to mention, since we're talking about ships right now, is it's important to realize that the Allied leadership worked with the Zionist community to prohibit Jews from settling anywhere else but Palestine. In fact, the Red Cross, the Red Cross was actually sending relief ships to Europe from the Mediterranean. They left from Spain. They landed in southern France, which was occupied by the Nazis. But they were unloading packages for people in the concentration camps. And the International Red Cross confirmed that the packages were being delivered. However, the American and British allies authorized the sinking of three Red Cross transport ships that were carrying supplies to the concentration camps. The names of the ships were the Padua, the Embla, and the Christina. All of these ships were clearly marked as Red Cross ships. Nevertheless, they were all bombed and sunk by British and American bombers. And after the Christina was sunk, the International Red Cross stopped all shipments of aid to the concentration camps. And, you just wonder, I mean, how many Jewish and non-Jewish lives would have been saved if the Red Cross was allowed to deliver these parcels? And just one final observation here. On May 8th, 1945, after the war was over, it was reported that 7 million parcels weighing 35,000 tons were at sea or in warehouses in Britain, Lisbon, Barcelona, Marseille, Toulon, and Geneva and Gothenburg. These were supplies that were earmarked for the concentration camps, for the concentration camp internees, but because of the sinking of the Red Cross relief ships, they were never delivered. So
that's interesting. I would like to know much more about that. I have not researched this topic in any great detail. I actually just did a couple Google searches while you were speaking, and I have here, sure. This is directly from the Red Cross's website, World War II and the American Red Cross. The American Red Cross involvement in World War II preceded the entrance of the United States into the conflict. When hostilities began in Europe in 1939, the Red Cross became the chief provider of relief supplies for the civilian victims of conflict, distributed by the Geneva-based International Red Cross Committee. In February 1941, the Red Cross responded to a request by the U.S. government to begin a blood donor service to produce life-saving plasma for the armed forces in anticipation of America's entry into the war. After the attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, the Red Cross quickly mobilized a volunteer and staff force to fulfill the mandates of its 1905 congressional charter, requiring that the organization furnish volunteer aid to the sick and wounded of armies in time of war, and to act in manners of voluntary relief and in accord with the military and naval authorities as a medium of communication between the people of the United States of America and their army and navy. So they're playing up their role that they played during World War II in providing relief. But you're saying that the Allies were actually targeting their ships to prevent some of this relief aid. Okay, wow, that's interesting. I'm going to have to look more into that. So I guess this kind of goes back to a point that you made. You were saying earlier that like these quote-unquote big Zionist Jews conspired to exacerbate hardships in the concentration camps, right? Is that accurate?
That is exactly correct. Yes.
Well, see, and I guess that's another thing I sort of am confused about, because I'm not trying to downplay or dismiss the fact that some of these concentration camps were very difficult, living environments. You know, it was a difficult situation. But I think a lot of that has been just totally overblown and exaggerated. I mean, the German policy was not to murder these people. In fact, they were doing everything in their power to prevent them from being, harmed or, succumbing to disease. And, that's the whole purpose of Zyklon B. I mean, we've been told that Zyklon B was used to mass murder Jews in, gas chambers, when in reality it was used to kill the bugs that spread typhus. Exactly. And some of these other diseases. So exactly. This idea that these concentration camps were these horrific, torturous death camps or something is absurd and is not backed up by any evidence, including official German policy. I mean, if a German military member or SS member, mistreated a prisoner or did something, illegal, they were subjected to the full brunt of the law. And in many cases, they were executed. So how does that square with this idea that there were these like massive hardships in the concentration camps? I don't think there really were. I mean, to a large extent, until the end of the war, when mm-hmm. Germany was just collapsing. And again, this is a direct policy of the Allied, bombing campaign. They were bombing the civilian infrastructure, the rail, the rail lines that were used to supply the camps and to supply the war effort, which makes sense if you're in a war, right?
Of course,
think that the policy of the Allied government, the U.S. and the British primarily, as you mentioned, was what caused the hardships in the camps, not necessarily like these big Zionist Jews. I don't know. Can you maybe help me understand this a little bit better?
Let me begin here by a quote from Theodor Herzl, who was the founder of Zionism. This is from my article, The Holocaust, Big Zionist Jews versus Little Jews, in the September-October 2021 edition of the Barnes Review. It is essential that the suffering of Jews becomes worse. This will assist us in the realization of our plans. I have an excellent idea. I shall induce anti-Semites to liquidate Jewish wealth. The anti-Semites will assist us thereby in that they will strengthen the persecution and oppression of Jews. The anti-Semites shall be our, the Zionists, best friends. So, and then just to, give some other examples. I mean, there was a march. Let me see what the date of that march was. The March of the 400 Rabbis. That was, see where that article is here. Yeah, that happened on October 6, 1943. 400 rabbis marched on Washington, D.C. They actually marched to the White House because they wanted to bring to the attention of the public the suffering of Jews in concentration camps in Europe. FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, was at the White House. But when the rabbis marched on the White House, he literally absconded through the back door because he did not want to meet them. And the rabbis were left talking to some minor official of the White House because FDR had literally left, and then he immediately went on a vacation after that. His close friend and advisor, Stefan Wise, he said that he praised FDR for not meeting with the 400 rabbis. His quote was, "Mr. President, you wouldn't want to be associated with these people." The point is, if word got out that there actually was a Holocaust happening during World War II, that would put pressure on the Allies either to bring the war to a quicker conclusion or to possibly negotiate a conditional peace with the Nazis. And that is something the Zionists did not want. They did not want a conditional peace because they wanted the war to last as long as possible in order to make sure that Jews were suffering. And that's the other reason they didn't want the Holocaust publicized. They didn't, you know, during the war, their knowledge of the Holocaust was consistently suppressed. The Holocaust, obviously, the Orthodox account of the Holocaust, and that was suppressed because they didn't want, they wanted to steer Jews to Palestine, and they did not want them to settle in other countries. Most of the Jews at the end of World War II, their main wish was to resettle in the United States. There was a board set up, the War Refugee Board, which was set up by FDR. But the people that he appointed to the War Refugee Board, I believe the head of it was Morgenthau, who was Jewish, and he was a devout Zionist. And they discouraged any immigration of Jews from Europe to the U.S. with the goal of steering them to Palestine. The War Refugee Board was only operational for about a year before it was shut down. And like I said, the purpose of all this was to direct Jewish concentration camp survivors in particular to resettle in Palestine. And there's other things I can mention as well here. For example, something I haven't talked about before was the Evian Conference. This was a conference in France from July 6th to July 15th in 1938. It was a conference called to deal with the Jewish question, namely, what do we do about resettling Jews outside of Nazi Germany? And about 32 nations participated, although Nazi Germany was not invited, curiously enough. But at the end of this conference, only one country agreed to take in Jews, and that was the Dominican Republic. The United States, France, England, etc., refused to take in any more Jews. And it's interesting, the Evian Conference, EVIAN, which was called by FDR and was held in France in the city of Evian, FDR did not send a State Department official. He only sent one of his personal friends, a banker named Myron Taylor, as his representative. So there was no official government representative there. And what's interesting, if I can ask you this, Evian spelled backwards, John spells what?
Evian spelled backwards.
E-V-I-A-N.
So it's spelled N-A-I-V-E? Naive?
Yes. Naive, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, I think there was a lot of, conferences and stuff that were given very significant names. And I think that this obscure town in France, I think, was chosen to send a message to Nazi Germany that it was naive of them to think that they're going to let Jews relocate from Nazi Germany. You may disagree with that, but I find it very curious the name of the town that meeting was held at. So anyway.
Well, it's definitely interesting. I don't know what more to read into it. You're making some interesting points. One thing that came up, going back to, you had said that like during the war, like the media wasn't reporting about the quote unquote Holocaust. What do you mean? Like, what is the Holocaust to you? Because I mean, well, I said at the beginning, like the official story of the Holocaust and its like key tenets is just not. There's no evidence for any of it. So, like, what do you mean by the quote-unquote Holocaust? What does that mean to you?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I should define my terms. Yeah, what I mean by the Holocaust, I typically use that word when referring to the Orthodox Jewish account of the Holocaust, which is false. You know, it's untrue. It's not scientifically testable. It's a dogma. You know, it's untrue. What I mean by the Holocaust, you know, I mean, if you asked me what happened during the Holocaust, I would agree with you, John. I don't know of anyone who was actually scientifically demonstrated to have died from being gassed with Zyklon B in the concentration camps. In fact, there was a forensic scientist. Let me get his name here. Let's see here. What was his name? Charles Larson. He was appointed by Eisenhower to do autopsies at the concentration camps to find out why people died. He did not find a single instance of anyone dying from Zyklon B, which is a variant of cyanide. He did not find a single example of someone having died from being gassed to death with Zyklon B or any other chemical for that matter. And, you know, he gave testimony at the Nuremberg trials, but his testimony was off the record, and his findings, you know, it was kept from the public record, and his findings were never published, at least not his testimony to the Nuremberg tribunal. Only after the war, he made some, he was interviewed after the war, and after the war, he acknowledged that virtually all of the deaths at the concentration camps were the result of typhus or starvation. As a result of, food not being delivered to the German concentration camps. So, you know, I find it very interesting that, you know, we're told, and this just goes back to, you know, the chutzpah, the incredible misinformation about the Orthodox account of the Holocaust. You know, we're told that millions were gassed to death, but there's literally not a single scientific autopsy that would demonstrate that even one Jew died of cyanide or Zyklon B poisoning. And if that were true, I can assure you that Jewish Holocaust scholars, if they had evidence, actual evidence from autopsies of Jews being gassed to death, they would be shouting that from the rooftops.
Right. Well, but, the only evidence for that is this eyewitness testimony.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's basically it. And it was rumors, and you know, these rumors got circulated that people were getting gassed to death, and yeah, it was just all hearsay. There was no actual evidence to support any of it.
Yep. There's no corroborating evidence that the so-called eyewitness testimony is true.
Right.
And if someone dies of Zyklon B poisoning, it basically affects the oxygen intake in their red blood cells. So their bodies typically turn a very bright, cheery red. And of all the films I've seen of the death camps, well, I shouldn't even use that phrase, but of the concentration camps, I have yet to see a colorized, and we can colorize the film taken at the camps. I have yet to see a single cherry red corpse in any of the mass graves at any of those camps. And I've repeatedly asked the Jewish community here in the Twin Cities. I've emailed the the head of the Holocaust and Genocide Department at the University of Minnesota. I've contacted Yad Vashem in Israel, and I've asked all of them, you know, to join with me to do a statistical scientific investigation, an autopsy of the deceased at the camps to establish once and for all whether they died, whether anyone died of Zyklon B poisoning or not. And no one has ever responded back to me. No one, you know, I mean, this, you know, this would settle the issue once and for all. And, you know, I'm not asking us to dig up 6 million bodies. You know, we could just do a statistical survey at the camps, you know, maybe a few hundred, and determine if any of them can be shown to have died of Zyklon B poisoning. But all, you know, I met with silence. You know, no one in the Jewish community that I've invited to join with me to call for such an investigation, no one in the Jewish community has agreed to settle that issue once and for all using science. And that I think that speaks a lot.
Yes. That's very typical.
Yeah. I think that's
their typical
loudly.
Response.
Yeah. And again, you know, in the public mind, we're the bad guys. You know, the revisionists are the bad guys, which is so untrue, because all the revisionist books that I've read and the people I've talked to, they're open to new information and they're open to being found wrong. You know, they're open to that. But, you know, we're the bad guys because we're challenging a dogma which is unscientific and unprovable, the Orthodox account of the Holocaust. And again, you know, we're trying to give an honest and accurate account of what really happened, but you know, we're the ones who are the deniers, not the true deniers. I mean, I like to call myself a Holocaust truther instead of a Holocaust revisionist, even, because what I want is the truth, you know. And if I'm wrong, you know, if it turns out that yes, hundreds of Jewish bodies have been found to have been gassed to death, I'll be the first one to admit that I was wrong. But I don't see that happening. I don't see the Jewish community being willing to test that hypothesis.
I agree with that. So, well, one thing that cannot be denied is this story of the Holocaust. Because really, I think that's what it is. I mean, the Holocaust is like a story. It's a narrative. It is a largely fabricated, I mean, almost entirely fabricated and just true. Concocted narrative that has just been institutionalized throughout society. In the aftermath of World War II, I mean, you had mentioned how, you know, the quote unquote Holocaust wasn't really presented in the press, you know, during World War II. I don't know if I totally agree with that, because I mean, there was all sorts of reports of, you know, very, very scandalous, sensational reports about Jews being murdered and, you know, stuff, you know, gassed to death and stuff like that were coming from some of these Jewish news outlets in Europe. So there was like, they were basically setting the stage, you know, sort of paving the way for this overall narrative of 6 million Jews systematically murdered. And, you know, there were they were basically reporting rumors and hearsay and, you know, eyewitness testimony, none of which was accurate or reliable or even plausible in many cases. I mean, some of the stuff that they were reporting was outrageous and just ridiculous. And, you know, again, a lot of the claims that they make to this very day are implausible and ridiculous and absurd and frankly insulting to any critically thinking individual. So, I mean, for sure, the narrative itself and the alleged suffering has been used to justify the cause of Zionism. So I agree to, you know, I definitely agree with that. I mean, and it has shut down, you know, critique of the concept of Zionism. I mean, there still are, you know, some anti-Zionist groups out there operating. They're not very effective. And, you know, of course, they would never challenge the Holocaust story or anything like that. You know, they're more concerned with just like the mistreatment of Palestinians and this idea of like Israel being like a quote unquote like racist state, that sort of thing. But for sure, the narrative itself has been used to advance Zionism and shut down any sort of critique of it, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the issue, you know, you're right. I mean, there wasn't absolutely no mention of Jewish suffering in the camps during the war. What I'm referring to is an article in the Barnes Review of May, June, 2019, entitled "How the World Jewish Congress Invented the Holocaust Legend." And it points to a document issued from the government on November 26, 1944. That was when the office of the president first acknowledged publicly that there was allegedly German extermination camps. So that's you know, sort of what I'm referring to as when I speak about official acknowledgement of the Holocaust, as Orthodox Jews would have you believe.
Okay, but
there is one other thing I want to mention, though, before you know our conversation ends here. You know, I used to be a member of the Jewish Voice for Peace. It was a Jewish organization that would criticize Israeli misbehavior in the Middle East, and you know, it would appear to be an organization that let me put it this way: the Jewish Voice for Peace, it's an advocacy website, but it almost certainly is a Zionist front organization, as I've come to understand it, because I was on one of their podcasts and listening to the conversation, and I texted a message, you know, just two paragraphs, basically outlining that, you know, the real perpetrators and beneficiaries of the Holocaust were big Zionist Jews, because they got hitherto non-Zionist Jews to people their Zionist state, you know. And that was the whole point of the Holocaust. Anyway, once I texted that, I was deleted from the podcast, and you know, it got me to thinking. You know, why? You know, what's going on here? You know, they didn't. You know, nobody addressed any of my arguments about Zionist Jews wanting the Holocaust. They just deleted my conversation, and as a result of that, I've come to believe more and more that the Jewish Voice for Peace is, in fact, a Zionist front organization to give the appearance to the non-Jewish public that there is a vibrant, you know, Jewish opposition to Israeli misbehavior. And another thing that kind of clued me into the fact that the Jewish Voice for Peace is most likely a Zionist front organization is the fact that they delisted Alison Weir. I don't know if you know who Alison Weir is, but she has a she has.
She's AmericansKnew.org, I think, is the website.
Yeah, that's the website, and she wrote a book, Against Our Better Judgment. But in any event, the Jewish Voice for Peace delisted her from their organization and condemned her. And accused her of being anti-Semitic. And the reason is that she did not give a balanced account of the deaths between Palestinians and Jews. She only focused on Palestinian suffering. What the Jewish Voice for Peace wanted was equivalency, that there was, you know, deaths were on both sides. And basically the tactic that they were employing was to create a false equivalency between Israeli and Palestinian deaths, with the goal of giving a false impression that both Palestinians and Israelis are equally to blame for the troubles. So, I don't know if you know, hopefully some people in your listening audience is aware of Jewish Voice for Peace, but I think there's quite a bit of evidence for it being a Zionist front organization done for public relations purposes to fool the Gentile public into thinking that there is more criticism of Israel than in fact there is. So I just did want to mention that. So
right, yeah, no, interesting. Yeah, that's I wouldn't be surprised, honestly. Well, and maybe even if they're not necessarily like a front organization, just the fact that these people are just unwilling, unable to engage in any sort of critical discussion about World War II, about the alleged Holocaust, is very, very telling and is a huge red flag. I mean, again, this, as we said from the very beginning, this is like the one aspect of history that you're just simply not allowed to question. I mean, I guess there's other aspects as well, but this one in particular is, you know, the number one issue that you're not allowed to question. I think a lot of it has to do with just this very emotional and psychologically traumatizing propaganda in the in the narratives that we've been told, the testimony, the Hollywood movies, the imagery associated with it all is very, very powerful, and it prevents people from even thinking critically about this event, you know?
Yeah, I know. It's sad. I have a friend, you know, I go out for coffee with, and his father, interestingly enough, you know, he's an elderly man, but his father actually was in the 1st German Air Force Division, and he fought in Germany on the side of the Nazis. But in any event, whenever I talk to him to kind of get his take on it, I mean, I can, you know, he's afraid to think. He is literally afraid to think. His you know, he wants to change the topic immediately. He gets very defensive. He for bringing up the topic about what really happened during the Holocaust. And I think the media has so indoctrinated the public that, you know, he's not unusual. People are afraid to think outside the box when it comes to the Holocaust. And there's literal fear, you know. I mean, it's masterful what they've done, you know, to promulgate the orthodox account of the Holocaust. It's just, you know, through their control of the media, they've, you know, while in Europe, I mean, you can go to jail and be fined and all that for contradicting the Holocaust or raising issues about the Holocaust. In the U.S., they don't necessarily send you to jail or fine you, but it's career suicide, and you'll be ostracized by, you know, people who don't have a clue about the Holocaust. You know what I mean? It's just, I can certainly understand the frustration in the revisionist community for acknowledging something that's so transparently true, namely that the orthodox account of the Holocaust is false, you know, and it's so transparently true that there are problems with the orthodox account of the Holocaust, but not being able to communicate that to the public in general because they're so indoctrinated into the belief that 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust, and if you question that, you're a closet Nazi yourself. It's just extremely frustrating. Frustrating.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it is frustrating, but I think we're slowly but surely making progress, and it's certainly in my mind a very respectable and honorable endeavor to stand up and tell the truth about these things and openly discuss them.
Well, somebody has to.
Yeah. Exactly. And I know that's certainly your mindset. That's what you do with a lot of your writings. And, of course, that's what the Barnes Review is all about as well. So, Vaughn, I'll tell you what. We're going to have to wrap up here in just a second, but this was a very interesting conversation. We should definitely do this again. I think you're making a lot of good points. Don't get me wrong. I mean, some of it, I guess, I just need to think a little bit more about and read more about. But overall, for sure, I mean, the Holocaust narrative itself, the alleged hardships and persecution and suffering of the Jews have been used to the hilt by the Zionist community to justify the state of Israel, to shut down any criticism of what the Jews are up to. So, I mean, there's a lot that we certainly agree with. And, I think it's a very interesting topic. Again, you know, you've written about this pretty extensively. I'll have links over to your website and also your page on VT Foreign Policy. I was just looking at that article you wrote about the, or I guess it's more an article that you edited about the Liberation of the Camps, Facts versus Lies. That's a very interesting article.
That actually was a supporting article written by another Holocaust revisionist. I wanted to give more evidence
right.
to the fact that that there's no proof that any Jews died by being gassed to death in the camps, and that article supports that. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's very interesting. So I would encourage people to check out the links when I post the podcast. And Vaughn, it was great to meet you, man. We'll definitely have to do this again. Keep up the good work and stay in touch. And yeah, I look forward to future contributions in the Barnes Review.
All right, John, have a good rest of the week, and thank you for taking the time and for interviewing me.
Okay, thank you, sir. Have a good one. I'll talk to you soon.
Sure. Goodbye.
Bye.